Hello again, it's Mike Morin with another story of finding fulfillment in life's second act. Welcome to Reset, 40 is the new happy. My guest today is Joan O'Connor of Henniker. Formerly in jewelry sales, one of Joan's passions these days is finding a new home for the Tilton Winter Farmers Market that is leaving its home of 4 years at AutoServe dealership of Tilton. More on that in a moment, but first, take me back to a much earlier Joan O'Connor, the jewelry salesperson.
My goodness. I sort of fell into the job of repping jewelry lines. There was a man selling jewelry in downtown Henniker, and I was in his way. I was like looking over his shoulder, asking questions. He was selling to a gift shop. And he finally said, why don't you wait for me outside? And he hired me. I was just out of college, and I said, do I need a car? I was so innocent. I knew nothing of business. Communications major, photography, film, theater, you know, eclectic. I just took all sorts of courses. And so the business angle was a new learning arc for me. But anyway, I went on the road for him and then picked up more lines of jewelry over the years. So I did it for 20 years. I covered Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island. And I sold to the gift shops, department stores, boutiques, catalog houses, resort towns. I'd drive to Bar Harbor and back in 2 days, or I'd go to Burlington, Vermont and back. And then after a few years, the industry started changing, and I could see there was so much more competition, and it was getting harder out there. And also, my body started giving out of me. I got hit with an arthritis that went through about 95 joints, and I was running fevers. I was miserable. So I finally said, that's it. I'm off the road. And then I started thinking of what to do next. But during those many years, I was getting into worms, composting worms.
I got to stop you before there because I want to back up and ask you, did you make a decent living selling jewelry?
Yes, I was commission sales. I made 15% on whatever I sold. On the average in those days, I was making about $1,000 a day. So I'd work 2 days a week, half the year. I've never been really driven by money, but I loved the product that I was selling. I loved the jewelry designers, and my territory was beautiful. I'd be breezing down the highway up in Vermont, and I'd be listening to the traffic reports around in Boston, and I'm like, duh, 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 the sun setting and everything. So I loved the whole concept, and I encourage women to get into sales because of the commissions, because of the higher pay scale. Salespeople are the highest paid people in the world, and women make wonderful sales reps. And pick a product that you believe in and that you love, and be honest and get out there and sell.
All right, so you did a little time as a beekeeper, right? Was that a business venture, or was that just sort of an activity or a hobby?
That was a hobby. I always seem to be drawn towards male-dominated things. Like when I was doing the jewelry, it was 90% Jewish old men. And here comes O'Connor selling jewelry in Vermont and New Hampshire. And they were like, oh, God. But anyway, the bees was part of this. And I was always doing recycling and modest gardens. And then the beekeeping was to help the pollination. And I love the whole – bees are the second most societal after ants. Ants are amazing, and then bees are second. And they're 90% female worker bees and 10% drones. So I love that powerful women.
And the drones like the odds of a 9 or 10 to 1 ratio. I'm just speaking on behalf of the males in the audience. All right, so you bought a 640-square-foot one-room schoolhouse in Henniker, which is actually where we're conducting this interview. But when you bought it, Joan, it didn't have plumbing. How long until you gave in and installed running water?
Well, during that transition of trying to reduce my overhead, I called my real estate agent and I said, sell my house. And what do you have on the market? And she said, well, I've got this little schoolhouse. And I knew of the schoolhouse. I used to have a boyfriend out beyond here, and I would drive by this, and I just loved it. And there were these two women that would vacation up here, so I knew it was a summer home. And when we came in, the woman had passed away, and the realtor was showing it to me. And it hit me because I'm surrounded by farm fields. You know, all my neighbors are paying the big property taxes. So I just sit here and enjoy the view. This is only a fifth of an acre here. And I'm only 3 miles from downtown Henniker. So anyway, it hit me. But it was no running water, no septic, no heat, no insulation. So I knew I was going to be bucking a lot of the regulations and everything, but I could move in because it was grandfathered. It had been a summer home. But then the complicated part was my family, my parents, didn't want me to live here. They wanted me to buy a condo. And I said, sorry, you know, that's not me. They lived down in Pennsylvania at the time, and I've been here since 1971, and I wanted to take this on. So I lived here without running water for 4 years. And it was an exercise in planning and figuring out, okay, the dog just puked, and I got to go put on a kettle of boiling water so I can clean up things. But anyway, it worked, and I got through it, and it wasn't that hard. I actually loved it because my life was simple, and I didn't have the high overhead. I didn't have the bills coming in. I did have electricity. I had a refrigerator and oven and everything. But finally, my parents were flustered, and they said, okay. My dad said, do you want money now or when I die? I said, I'll take it now, Dad. So he paid for my septic system. He paid for my well drilling. And my sister's an interior decorator, and she came up here and helped me with some of the layout of the kitchen. I have an IKEA kitchen, and but I'm also cobbing things together with recycled things. And, you know, I see something in a junkyard, and, you know, so I adapt things. But again, I lowered my overhead. I can clean this place in about 45 minutes. I can dust and vacuum, and it's easy.
And you have a big long-haired dog, so that, you know, probably adds to the time too, huh?
That's not too bad. Yeah, but you're right. Things get dirtier faster. You don't have so many places to hide things. You can't put it in that extra bedroom or whatever. So everything has to have a duality. You know, the thing right in front of us holds my shoes. You know, it's a coffee table, but there's shoes inside there. Everything is a storage ability. You learn to look up. You learn to go not broaden out, but to, you know, do shelving and things, get things up.
All right. So you really have a minimal carbon footprint, I guess would be one way to put it. You live very modestly. You appear to be very happy, and you raise worms. So does this pay the bills, raising what are these, red wigglers, right?
Right. This is a special worm that doesn't mind being in a container, and it eats your garbage. All those kitchen scraps you put up on your counter, fruits, vegetables, eggshells, coffee grounds, tea bags, paper towels, paper plates, beans, rice, pasta, bread. No meat, no fish, nothing greasy and oily, and like a little bit of humor, no dead cats. So that's what you're going to be putting into this little Rubbermaid container, and they process it rapidly. And I've been doing it for about 20 years. I got into it because I got fed up with a frozen compost pile behind my house all the time in the wintertime. And I did some research and learned about these worms. And then it started gaining momentum as people were getting into more of, you know, Earth Day and more of recycling and composting. But it's my accountant is very mad at me. She said, Joan, I want to set this up as a hobby because you're not making any money at this. And I'm like, no, it's not a hobby. And in agriculture, you're allowed to lose money for 5 years. And so I said, no. But anyway, I always have like 4 or 5 jobs. I always have odd jobs, and I like the diversity. I never did a 9-to-5. If anything, I would work 3 days in a row, 12 hours a day or whatever, whenever I had my weird jobs, or because I don't have the overhead. I don't, at my age, I don't have any debt. And that's just the way I like it, because my friends are putting kids through college and all this, and they've got these huge houses, and I know that they're just burdened with big bills, and I don't.
All right, so I promised we would talk a little bit about the very, very popular Tilton Winter Farmers Market, and I'm sure there's some people that don't know that, well, you didn't lose your lease, but you don't have the usual spot that you did, which was AutoServe Dealerships of Tilton. So now it's in your lap. You need to find a new place. And secondly, I know that you're a very big proponent of vendors who are interactive and bring samples are usually more successful.
Yes, I got into managing farmers markets because someone said you'd make a good manager. I said, sure, it pays. So I did that. And then I started my own markets because I wanted more control. I didn't really want to have to be accountable to board of directors or anything. I wanted to make all the decisions and act on things and not be delayed. So I started winter farmers markets because it was a component that wasn't really being covered in New Hampshire. And in the summertime, there's about 50 to 90 farmers markets. In the winter, when I started, there were only 10. And now there's probably 15 or 20, and some of them are going towards year-round markets and stuff. So it's exponentially, we're getting more of these wonderful venues where people can buy local fresh food. And I love facilitating this. I've had 50 vendors, and my markets run from December, January, February, March. And AutoServe was just an angel for me. They're amazing people to work with. But they had a huge building. They bought an old Agway building across from their dealership. And for 4 years, they hadn't found someone to lease it that, you know, was going to stay in there. So then finally, and he gave it to me every winter. He said he'd hand me the keys and say, sure, you can have it again. And I'm like, thank you. So for 4 years, it was just a wonderful opportunity. They really helped me with most of the overhead, snow plowing, salting, sanding, heat, electricity. And then I just did everything else. And they loved it. They'd never been in a farmer's market. So when all their people came walking in and the town of Tilton people came, they're like, holy smokes, who are all these people? And their products. And so here are these 50 wonderful vendors that have made career changes, that have pursued their passion. You know, they decided they wanted to make pastry or whatever, you know, whoopie pies or whatever they wanted to make, and mustards and jams and jellies and breads and raw milk. And so they have these booths, maybe 10 feet by 10 feet. And then with the public, they're allowed to stand right there and answer all those questions. They can put out samples. You can taste that bread. You can taste that sausage or that cheese or whatever, and ask questions directly to the farmer or to the person who's producing this. And also, I like to say I hope I run a pretty tight ship for food handlings, food safety. Many of these vendors, they've made this commitment, and they have insurance. They all have to have a $1 million liability policy to be in my market, because that covers all of us. That covers AutoServe. That covered me. That covered, you know, if anybody fell in the parking lot, if a table collapsed on someone's foot, if they got food poisoning, whatever might have happened, we're all protected with our insurance policies. And so that made these vendors take on that commitment. Okay, I'm going forward with my company, and I'm going to be doing farmers markets. And they, you know, I put them on Cook's Corner on Channel 9. It's a 3-minute cooking segment at the end of our news, and these people are terrified. They've never been on live TV before, but I'm there behind the camera, jumping up and down and telling them to smile and everything, and I'm making sure their displays look good. But I love to watch the transition when they have gotten through that 3 minutes and they survived. They didn't pass out. They didn't puke, and so they, you know, they're drained. They look at me like, wow. Thank you, Joan. And now I've opened that door. They can contact these stations and these radio stations and learn how to make these kind of calls themselves and get these bookings, because I know that these stations want these stories. They are all beautiful stories. Many of them have retired from being architects or whatever, and now they're doing their passion.
All right. So as we talk today, this is August. Winter's market is several months away, but Your people that the vendors need to make plans. So how close are you to not getting it done this year?
Well, power of positive thinking. People say if anybody can do it, you can, Joan. So that's why I'm a little panicky. You're right. By August, the vendors, many of them need to make business plans as far as putting some extra crops in the ground. They need to start raising their animals, you know, like if they need to buy the cattle or the sheep, or they need to buy the extra chickens so they will start laying eggs, you know, in the wintertime and everything. So I'm getting a few leads. I did a major press release. I have a wonderful person that helps me with marketing, and she knows how to get this word out there. And I'm getting phone calls, but many of them just don't quite accommodate 50 vendors. I need 12,000 square feet. I need a building that's slightly heated. I need parking for 70 cars of the customers and 50 cars of my vendors. So there's this requirement here, but I'm pushing myself. I'm making scary phone calls for myself, where I'm taking a few deep breaths and like, oh God, I got to call this corporate place, you know, down in, you know, Connecticut or whatever, that doesn't, you know, what do they care about a stupid farmer's market in New Hampshire? So I'm, and one of my favorite lines is, the sale begins when the customer says no. When that person on the other line says, no, we don't want a farmer's market, I have to come back at them fast with a whole different angle, with, you know, and just be thinking quickly on my feet, and then, you know, not giving up, not saying, oh, okay, I just keep coming at them. If my heart says this, something is right, I'll go for it.
So we've established that you live in a repurposed 640 square foot one room schoolhouse. You live modestly. I love the surroundings. Could I call you a hippie?
Oh, definitely. I was showing someone a picture in my yearbook. I used to wear the tie-dye shirt. I used to have the wide leather watch band. There I'm talking to George McGovern, you know, back in the 70s or whatever, and, you know, so there's a nice photograph. Yes, I was definitely a hippie. I'll show you high school. I was wearing black all the time and little mini skirts in those days and, you know, with the Joan Baez look. So, yeah, I'm a hippie. I'm proud of it.
All right, so if I were to look into your record collection, I'm going to guess that you might have some old vinyl somewhere around the house. Who are some of the artists I would find that you like to listen to?
I was more of a vocalist. I didn't really like the electric. I had older brothers and sisters that were doing Jefferson Airplane and Rolling Stones and Beatles, and I was like, yeah, it's okay. But I was drawn more to the acoustic. So and there was a really good folk club outside of Philadelphia in Bryn Mawr called the Main Point, and I would see everybody from Jerry Jeff Walker to Janicee and to Tom Rush. You know, that era of just that wonderful. You know, Jerry Jeff Walker was my favorite. You know, I just could listen to him all day. And even today, I'm still into more of instrumentals and something, you know, I mean, I don't really like loud, obnoxious music.
So, I mean, I'm sure you realize that Tom Rush is a neighbor here in New Hampshire.
Well, yeah, but he doesn't live in New Hampshire anymore. He, you know, comes and goes. But, yeah, I catch him once in a while, and he plays in Deering once in a while in a small venue with, you know, just him on the stage and whatnot. But I miss him. I wish he'd stayed in New Hampshire, but at least it gives him good material.
And to kind of bring this full circle about, you know, living your dream, your path, you're determining your own future, what do you say to somebody listening to this right now that is maybe on the edge, wanting to jump and fulfill their life the way that you have, completely devoid of other people's opinions?
Jump. Do it. And there's a book called Lean In. Read that book. It gave me little words of wisdom. So I'd say, just do it. Everybody says that. Just do it. Just get into it. And find your mentor. Find someone that's in that field, someone that like, I'll take you on. You know, if you want to do a food thing, contact me. I have mentored so many people. I may not be perfect, and I'm not a scientist. I always clarify that. Remember, my degree was, you know, communications or whatever. But I've been doing it, and I love it, and I know a lot of people. And they may love me, and they may hate me, but they know not to ignore me. And I encourage people to try it. Although you better keep your day job. That's what they say in agriculture. Keep the day job and pursue that passion. Pursue that barbecue sauce or whatever you know your friends tell you. You better get out there and make this commercially. Do it. And there's some wonderful support systems with the Cooperative Extension Service, Department of Agriculture. So whatever the field is, find those experts. Find those after hours Chamber of Commerce type of a things. And just grab onto someone that you admire and positive, someone who's very happy and just loves their field or whatever. And you're not going to get rich, especially in New Hampshire, especially if it's food related. It's a hard road, but you can get out of bed smiling in the morning, and you're not driven by, you know, the sales quotas and all the pressure that a lot of these companies.
As you once were.
Well, luckily I wasn't under too much pressure, but they were happy to have a rep up in New England. This would be a California company, like, and they would look on a map. They go, sure, you can have it. So they were happy to have the sales coming out of this area. But but you're right. There still were expectations, but I did the best I could.
Joan O'Connor, we'll make sure that the information, in fact, it is on our page. So if people want to get in touch with you, they can. Worm farmer and proponent for New Hampshire farmer markets and vendors. Thanks, Joan.
Thank you very much.